Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going on a journey with a fascinating author, teacher, student, whatever. He's a man who has experienced a lot in his life and on all levels of reality, including a fascination with people who have had near-death experiences. He was a pediatrician at a pediatric hospital, and there were kids having near-death experiences. So there's a lot to talk about with our fascinating guest. He's been on the show a number of times before. I'm so glad to have him back, Melvin Morse. Melvin, welcome.
Thank you so much, Peter. It is such a joy to be on your program. We can talk about things on your program that, you know, I've been on Oprah, I've been on Larry King, I've been on Coast to Coast, and I can tell you I've never had more interesting conversations than we've had. It just, I think that you are really on the cutting edge of spirituality.
Now, if we can only get 10 million people to hear you say that, that would be great. Thank you so much. I really am honored by that. So you've had a lot of struggles in your life that changed you. Originally you were, or at least you,
absolutely,
you write about having been too caught up in your ego and materialism, and you were a doctor who, I guess you might call, you were arrogant about who you were and what you were doing. And you ended up getting...
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you ended up getting caught.
The universe said, you're flying too high. You've had... It's wonderful because, you know, they say that both fame and failure are the same. And I've experienced fame and I've experienced failure. And it's funny, one of the manuals, as I call it, is written in the, I think about the 13th century by a Tibetan monk. It's called the 37 Verses on How to Be a Compassionate Person. And he says in there that you have to regard fame and failure, you have to see them as both teaching you, as your teachers.
Sure.
And that your sense of reputation is like, this is a Tibetan master saying, it's like blowing snot out your nose. But I'll just give you a thumbnail sketch, Peter, of what happened with me.
Sure.
I was a pediatrician at the University of Washington, studied near-death experiences in children, and did this work when I was in my early 30s. At the same time, I was honored as a pediatrician. I received what they call the Best Doctor Award for American pediatricians. You know, it just seemed like anything I did was golden. I wrote a book. It became an international bestseller. I had a thriving pediatric practice. I was honored as being one of America's best pediatricians, and I got full of myself. You know, this all happened at a fairly young age, and I just really had the idea that my ego, that I could do anything. And it's ironic because what I was learning, I was studying the near-death experiences of children. And what these children were telling me, these children who, you know, have been to the point of death, have died, many of them, and then resuscitated. And I can tell you this, Peter, because by and large, these are children that either I or my medical team resuscitated from death. So I don't have to rely on, you know, reading someone else's medical charts or hearing some sort of a story. These are experiences that I directly witnessed. As an example, this young boy came over to Seattle Children's Hospital, And he had a full-blown cardiac arrest in the lobby waiting room. And we resuscitated him right there. As a, you know, we didn't have time to take him to the emergency room even. And after we successfully resuscitated him, he looked at me and he opened his eyes and looked at me and he said, "That was weird. You guys just sucked me back into my body." So, you know, when you hear something like that, you know that, you know, you know that it's true. You know that it's real. But the message that these children were telling me is that we're here for a reason. And that is that this reality is a school. And we're here to learn lessons of love. And I can tell you that I lectured on this, and I told people this, and I explained to them, and I felt that I was, you know, just so filled with wisdom and helping grieving parents and all of this. And yet in my personal life, things were really deteriorating, and I did not learn my lessons of love. And to make a long story short, I did this myself. I created a very toxic, ugly environment in my personal life. And this resulted in my stepdaughter making false accusations against me.
And
these accusations, these accusations resulted in my being convicted of child endangerment. It was very dramatic. It was like headlines all over the country. A pediatrician waterboards his stepdaughter. I couldn't believe that people really took that seriously, because oddly enough, I was never accused of waterboarding her, but was convicted and spent 2 years in prison. And went through that experience of feeling that I'd lost everything. Lost my family, lost my reputation, my license to practice medicine, all of these things that I really, you know, this is who I thought I was. And yet I discovered something even more than that. I discovered a relationship that I finally developed with this God that's what kids call it. So I'm going to call it God, because virtually all the children that I resuscitated told me that they saw God, you know, that, you know, not a higher power, not a, you know, all the different names that we have for God. And I learned my lessons of love. I learned them in prison. I was humbled. My ego destroyed. And in fact, learned astonishing lessons of love. And I couldn't have learned them any other way, Peter. I really couldn't. Right. When I look at the flow of my life, I don't could have learned any other way.
And the people you met in prison were a big part of your growth. Right?
who knew? Who knew, Peter, that you would find people who had committed murder, carjackers, mostly drug addicts. Let's face it. You know, the sad reality is that most of the people in prison are heroin or methamphetamine addicts who had to steal or otherwise commit crimes to support their habits. That's the sad reality. I mean, I know that prior to my going to prison, I think I felt like everybody else, you know, oh my God, you know, don't let those people out of prison. The public won't be safe and there's going to be rapists roaming the streets. That's actually not the case. I would say easily 70 to 80% of the people in prison are addicted to drugs, alcohol, heroin, methamphetamine, and are not being treated.
Right.
But having said that, who knew that these people would teach me spiritual lessons and the near-death experiences I heard from them are unlike any near-death experience I've ever heard, and yet were more compelling and more convincing and more humbling than really. You know, most of these, let's face it, I've lectured, as you know, Peter, you know, with your radio program, the people on your show, it's mostly new age, it's mostly white, upper middle class or middle class audiences. and people who don't have particularly challenging spiritual problems. It's very different when you hear these types of near-death experiences and spiritual awakenings in men who have committed very serious crimes.
Right. And well, and, I want you to know
I'll tell you the one that, that.
Okay, please.
I'll just tell you one that, that humbled me that, tremendously is this a young man named Jamal. And from the inner city of the city of Wilmington, the murder capital in the United States, told me he had been hustling and dealing drugs since he was 12. Had never been employed. Virtually his entire life, when he wasn't in prison, carrying a gun. And this is, it's funny how it came up. I was at a class with him that we take before release from prison, in which you have to talk about your plan for, you know, how, what you're gonna do after a prison. So he got up and he said, well, God already told me my plan. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah. And then he told me in the class of his near-death experience. And he had never even heard of a near-death experience before. I asked him, had he, did he know about these experiences? He said, listen, Doc, all I read is Hood books. I dropped out of school in eighth grade. I didn't know there was a term, a near-death experience. And yet he nearly died when he was in prison during this recent incarceration. He said that he floated out of his body. He saw people working on his body below him. He said he was in a room that was completely white. And then he said that God held him in his hand and told him that he had a plan for him. And he looked at me, Peter, and he goes, me? Who am I? And yet God said that even I have a plan. And he didn't know what the plan was, but he did know that this plan involved, after he was released, to not come back to prison again. And I was very skeptical of this. He told me everything had changed for him, that he was transformed. And I was like, Jamal, you're a drug dealer and you've just as much admitted that when you go back to the streets, you're gonna deal drugs again. And he said, Doc, that's all I know is dealing drugs. So I don't know, I can't tell you what I'm going to do. But I do know he got rid of all his girlfriends. The language, I can't use the language that he uses on your show, but got rid of all his girlfriends, was running women for prostitution from prison, got rid of all of that. Went to school, got a GED, and then that wasn't even enough for him. He went back and took classes and actually got a high school a diploma. Got involved with a woman who was a nurse and told me, Doc, my life has changed. And I had to understand that it challenged my own ideas of what is a transformation. We have our all ideas, and yet I had to look at his life for what it was and realize that each one of us is learning our own individual lessons, and that the transformation in his life may not be a transformation that I can understand. And yet, clearly, if you could see his face light up when he said, me, I didn't even know there was a God. And yet he's got a plan for me. That says God has a plan for every single one of us.
Right, and I certainly believe that we're all here living through patterns that we've chosen before we were born to fulfill in this life, including the hardships that we are facing. The difficulties, certainly, we're the road you've been on, I'm certain, was, it's called preordained. and you just didn't know about it because you're here to do the great work you're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I really,
Peter, this experience of mine has taught me that.
Sure. Of course. Now, I just want to go back to,
you know, there's no sense in me. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Peter, but I wanted to just say, I want to build on what you're saying. There's no sense in me getting angry at what happened to me. The prosecutor, the judge, I know we got together before this. You're going to be the prosecutor who, you know, falsely accuses you, and you're going to be the judge, and you're going to be the victim, and you're going to be the, you know, and we all play this role. And when I saw the men in prison and listened to the stories of their lives made the most sense if you understood that they were learning specific lessons of love.
Right.
And that's not what I thought being a criminal was all about. And yet, absolutely, there's just time and time again that their crimes involved them struggling with issues of love.
Well, I think the whole purpose of life is to come to this planet of struggle. Everybody faces struggle. Buddha said life is all of suffering. And we come here to find the light amidst the struggle. And we don't have to call it light. Yeah. We come here to fix things, to make it better, to help ourselves, to help others. In each way, we're seeking more light of that. And for some people, it's more successful than others. I think we're at an age where more and more people are going to find this sense of unconditional love, of unity, and compassion and empathy. We're moving more and more towards that. And the idea of working from a prison experience, many years ago, I actually volunteered at a maximum security prison for a while. I would drive there, it was about an hour and a half away. I'd drive there and then I'd speak to groups of prisoners, sometimes an auditorium full of them, about health and fitness and, you know, taking care of ourselves properly, lifestyle. And I'd put them through meditations and all kinds of interesting things. But I found them, it was a maximum security prison, and I found them, so many people there were just the nicest guys. You know, they really were super interested, super helpful, looked like they got along with each other very well. And yet I was only seeing more of a superficial part of it because I wasn't living there, I was only visiting. And I really got to see the humanity of these people. I never knew what they were there for. It wasn't part of the conversation. But I'm sure there were some ugly stories. But these were people who had, you know, found some humanity themselves to act very human and in a good way.
That's the most surprising thing. That's the most surprising thing I learned as well, Peter.
Right.
And I want to emphasize what you said is so true. That I'll tell you something my attorney said. He's the top criminal defense attorney in Delaware. And he said, realistically, it's 45 seconds out of these people's lives that changes their lives forever. And, you know, so the by and large, you know, our idea that these men are sociopaths, or at least my idea that they're sociopaths or criminal personalities, was wrong. And I'll tell you who told me this. The best way is I asked the prison guards. I said to them, of the men who are, because who knows better than them? I said to them, of the men who are here, what percent do you think really need to be here? And again and again, even from the most jaded correctional officers, they would say, you know, maybe 10%. It said the rest are really no different than the rest of us. And, you know, they
made some bad choices.
They'd say it in a funny way. They'd say, you know,
they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, made some bad choices, and all of a sudden they were in trouble over their heads.
You know, who knows better than them? They live with these men day in and day out for year after year, and they were emphatic about it. That only 10% of the people there were fundamentally different from the rest of society.
Wow.
And these are, by and large, 45 seconds it changes your life.
When you say 45 seconds, what does that relate to?
Well, you know, one thing that came to a big surprise to me is that most people in the inner city carry weapons wherever they go. Some of these young men are, you know, they're as bright as any medical student I ever taught. They're decent, hardworking guys, but they just believe, probably rightly so, it's an environment I don't know anything about, but that they can't leave their house unless they have a gun. Well, if people are carrying guns around all the time, there's going to be, you know, you're going to get angry. You're going to make a stupid mistake. You're going to shoot somebody with that gun. And that might be the space typically of 45 seconds.
Okay.
From beginning to end.
Right.
That's a realistic, that's the 45 seconds that changes your life. Right. And, but the rest of your life, oddly enough, really, there's no difference between most of the young men I met and the smartest medical students that I worked with. They want to live a good life. Nobody wants to spend their time in prison. One of the most touching things when I was there was the men said to me, "Teach me how to think differently." Because even the most fundamental spiritual truths, such as you don't have to get someone before they get you. that's a spiritual understanding that most of the men I met believe. And it came as a tremendous shock to them to realize, hey, wait a minute, I can choose to react differently. And your work with meditation, I'm sure, Peter, that those men just soaked that up, because the men came to me and wanted to learn meditation. And I learned how to meditate from some of the people that society has discarded. And yet some of them are the most spiritually aware and connected people that you can imagine.
Sure.
And these are the men that we're locking up.
I have two close friends, husband and wife, who many years ago, they were very successful international marketers, had a big business. And one morning he woke up and said, "I'm giving up everything. I'm going to become a humble servant of others." And he quit. And his wife said, "What are we doing? I don't know about this." And then he went to divinity school, became a minister, and started working in prisons, and developed a huge world around him in prison of people who he helped find their way. And now the two of them, in separate prisons, he in a men's prison, she in a woman's prison, run theater groups. They create theatrical productions with the prisoners, and it's really helping them grow a lot. But it was interesting how he became a capitalist, and all of a sudden he was a man of God, and never went back.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So there's a lot of transformation, I think, that people are recognizing and even might want to know more about what to do with. And so it's great for them to hear, you know, these understandings of reality that, you know, we can help people. There is hope to help people find their light. And
absolutely.
Right.
The transformations that I saw were astonishing. Now, how much time do we have left, Peter?
Only a couple minutes.
Do you have time for a quick story?
We just have about 2 minutes left.
Okay. I'm going to tell you real quickly then, this illustrating how we're here to learn lessons of love. One of my friends in prison prayed that he would have a successful modification of his sentence. And he was taken to court and given every bit of hope that he could have that done. And he felt strongly that this was the answer to his prayers. And it didn't happen. And it didn't happen in a very dismissive way. They were just like, what are you doing here? You're not getting your sentence modified. And so I said to him, Peter, I said, well, what does this mean? What do you think, about God? And does this answer your prayers? And he just looked at me and he said, I love Jesus. So this has nothing, it didn't shake his faith at all. And I thought to myself, wow, that was his whole life, was to have his faith tested like that. What better way could there be if we're here to learn that particular lesson of faith than this man who had, believed strongly that he was going to have his prayers answered, his hopes dashed, and yet still believed.
Well, there's so much that you and I can talk about, and we're going to continue our conversations.
Absolutely. I want to talk about meditation.
All right. Well, I also want to hear about the NDE experiences of fascinating people that you've met, and you have so much
Absolutely.
To tell us about. So, Melvin Morse, is there a website or... give us a book title.
My website is Melvin Morse MD, .com. And okay. I've got another one is just melvinmorse.net.
Great. And people can see your books there and their videos, all kinds of good stuff.
Right.
Great.
MelvinMorse, like Morse code.
Right. Thanks so much, Melvin.
People want to hear about the criminal aspects, and what happened. That's melvinmorse.net. My son wrote that to try, to let the people know. He strongly supported me and was outraged at what happened to me.
Right.
And Melvin Morse, MD, is about the spiritual side.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much, Melvin, for being on Energy Stew. We'll see you soon again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Peter. I can't wait till we talk again.
Great. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.fm. I can be reached at Peter at HeartRiver, HEART, river.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.